So, look, thanks heaps for inviting me here and a great opportunity to chat to a range of people. What I want to talk to, you're based at AgResearch at Invermay near Dunedin. What I want to talk to today is about a large program of work we have called NZ Bidder for the bioeconomy and the digital age, and we are doing a huge amount of work in the digital space at animals, plants, the production systems, soils, but I don't have time to cram that into 20 minutes. So what I'm going to talk to today is a bit I've been leading around water quality sensors and how we might use that for farmers in the future. So I guess in the future people have this vision that, I'm going to put my glasses on so I can read the screen, trouble with getting old. In the future, people have this vision of farms, that we're going to have sensors all over the place and they're going to be measuring things on their farms, and with that, that will lead us to automatically making a whole lot of better decisions about how we do the farm, whether that's about increasing production or profitability or environmental impacts. But one of the challenges I keep pointing out as a scientist is that we've never actually seen that level of data at that frequency before, or at that spatial resolution of how many sites that we've got within a farm. So in other words, we've never seen this data, so we don't actually know how to interpret it yet. There's also massive lags in the system. Dawn's been talking about nitrate leaching from there. So if you pick up some nitrogen that's leaving your farm today, you don't know from Lisa's work which pathway by which that nitrate's got to the water, or when the decision was made that led to that level of leaching from there, because your decisions around what crops you sow, when you apply a fertiliser, are made months ahead of when you actually see it in the water. So one of the challenges with sensors when you're in the environment, they're just measuring a snapshot of the here and now. It's not telling you about where it's coming from. And it's like if you just reach out and take a grab sample of water out of a river flowing fast, you don't know whether the nitrogen in there only travelled a short distance from just upstream and so it arrived half an hour ago, or whether it entered the stream days ago upstream or come through our groundwater sources. So there's all of those massive lags that are in there. The other point is around one of my favourite topics, spatial and temporal averaging. So someone mentioned the Lawa sites earlier. This is where the councils take data from the rivers and put that onto a website. At the scale of which they're taking those measurements in our large rivers, you're seeing an integrated effect of maybe 100 farms, and also the data spread out over many days. So it's really hard to interpret those spikes that you might see, or what's happening in the water with what's happened immediately that you might think of in your head. And also that's one of the challenges of the disconnect between the what I call the farm scale and the catchment scale. Water quality is an issue that happens at a catchment scale, but the decisions around how you manage things are made at a farm scale, and that's one of the key challenges for policy and for water quality science, is how do we bridge that gap in a way that's useful. So I'll talk a bit about water quality sensors because of the ability they have from there. Just throwing up on a slide here, most people have the assumption that water quality sensors, and the ones that I am using, are at a fixed place within a stream. But they don't have to be in a fixed place, they can be mobile. So this picture here is what you call graphical abstract from a publication from Europe, where these guys took one of the E. coli sensor machines that I've got and stuck it in a boat and drove around the lake, and they were able to produce a 2D map of the E. coli contamination levels within that lake. So you can have one sensor and have it moving from there. So the ability to use drones if we can, we always think about flying drones because they're really cool and they buzz around and they look all right. You know, but we can put drones into water, into boats and things as well, and we can even have passive floating drones. So I think we need to keep our thoughts open to the future about what technologies could become available and how we might use those. And also, as a science geek, there's a whole lot of science about that and how we integrate data from spatial and temporal locations. If we look at the science about what's happening in the water quality sensor space, from what I can see happening around New Zealand and around the world, there are two fundamentally different ways in which people are approaching the technology. So on the left there I've got in green, people start with basically saying, what's something that's cheap to measure? Because realistically they have to be cheap to work, right? So what they end up is selecting sensors that look like, measure things like dissolved oxygen, temperature, pH and conductivity. And then they can measure those things, but the challenge then becomes, well, how do we interpret that? How does, how would measuring pH in a waterway lead back to helping you make a decision around your farm management? And so the trouble is with those systems that will come to getting the data and integrating it, we say, actually, we're not sure what decisions you can make with it. On the right-hand side, you start with your more traditional environmental science approach and say, well, what are the stream values that you're trying to measure? Do you want to have fish in your stream? Do you want to be able to swim in those streams? Okay, if you want to swim in there, then it's related to E. coli and the risk of getting sick and its turbidity, excuse me. In terms of your visual clarity of the water to make it an attractive place to swim, you say, okay, those are the attributes that we want to measure. It comes back to the famous four, nitrogen, phosphorus, sediments, and E. coli. And then what you end up with is some really expensive sensors. No one makes cheap ones in that space from there. And even for phosphorus, there is no sort of commercially available sensors. It's quite a difficult one to do. But that's the area where I've been working with those really expensive sensors, because I see there's a key role as a science organisation for us to be purchasing and starting to use this technology, starting to generate this high frequency data, so that as the sensors become cheaper in the future, then potentially we can start saying, this is the sort of questions they can ask you. And we could even potentially come down to a cost-benefit analysis that says, once we know how we can use this data, the sensors will have to get down to less than $500 or maybe less than $50 before they are something useful that you could put onto a farm. The other point I would make here is I'm not saying that, you know, dissolved oxygen temperature or pH conductivity and those sorts of cheaper measures are not important indicators of water quality. They're just not easy to relate back to farm management. And a lot of those do relate to things like point sources from a sewage discharge, or if you've got a factory discharging into a stream. But in terms of diffuse pollution sources from agriculture, we need to be looking at the more traditional sensors, contaminants of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediments, and E. coli. So hopefully they will get cheaper. The other thing that's always in the back of my mind is people talking about getting sensors to measure something. I'm always thinking about what other data sources are there that we can add to it to make layers. Like as we saw from Fonterra this morning, you start collecting one bit of data, you can link it to other data sources and get some more information out of it. So in the first stage of this project around water quality sensors, we had a whole series of proof of concepts. Because as an organisation, we hadn't done a lot of work in this space when we started a number of years ago. So we wanted a proof of concept to see if we could create a dashboard type system. So this is where you generate data. You then need to interpret that and convert it into information, maybe using models and visualisation tools, to then help you support a decision. And so when you start looking into the space for technology suppliers, most of the different companies out there will supply a limited range of sensors. And some of them even are, you've got an entire company dedicated to just producing one type of sensor, and that is all they do and all they sell. So they already have dashboards that come from the factory, but they're proprietary. It's only for their machine, and you can't link anything else into it. So that then becomes a real challenge. And these photographs here I've got, so this is Invermay with some flooding, as you can see. So the technology I've got in a garden shed, and just out the back you can see some solar panels. That's about half the size of the solar panel system. I had to double it in the end to generate enough power to run some of this equipment. And then on the right, we've got some stilling wells and some equipment I was just testing in a pond. I'll come back to this later, but the technology is not easy, and this area here is just over the fence out the back of our Invermay buildings. I had hoped to use the technology up on a site in North Otago, but trust me, it's much easier if you can just wander out the back of your office, change something on the machine, go back inside and check it works, rather than doing a 3-hour round trip every time you want to change something. So what I wanted to do here was, I've got three different types of sensors. So up in the top left, I've got some TRIOS probes coming out of Germany. So the top one is a nitrate and suspended solids sensor. The middle one is tryptophan, and the bottom one is a turbidity sensor for measuring suspended solids. They both have wipers on them. The middle one, you're all going, tryptophan, why on earth is Richard measuring an amino acid in the water? There's a little bit of data in the literature that says the bacteria in the hind gut of humans and animals produce high levels of tryptophan, so we may be able to use that as an indicator of fecal pollution. And I'll come back to that. In the middle, I've got a UniData sensor, which is just a level sensor that NIWA use on all their river monitoring sites. They're really stable and robust. And at the bottom, I've got a Coleyminder machine. This is basically a robot lab that draws in a sample, adds reagents to it, and calculates and measures an indication of E. coli using the same methodology that I would do in a laboratory. So I like it. It's looking for exactly the same target in the bacteria. To give you a reason why I chose the tryptophan sensor in there, the CoLeMinder systems are $86,000 each for a low voltage machine. They can, in theory, generate data every 30 minutes, but the consumable cost per sample is $6 per sample. So at the moment, I've been running them about every 6 hours, taking a sample from there. Heinously expensive, and that's without putting the solar panels on these guys to keep them running. Whereas the tryptophan sensor up the top is only $3,500. It just takes electricity, it uses a light beam, and so you can get a rough measure. So the theory in the long term is that if the tryptophan sensor gives us a rough signal, it's already a lot cheaper than going for the full-bore CoLeMinder systems. In order to get that data into the dashboard sitting on the right there, the top two, the Trios and the Unidata, go through the Neon systems, which NIWA use for their monitoring as well, so we just clip into their gear, which then goes up into a cloud-based server that NIWA use and then feed into the dashboard on the right. I'll come into a lot more slides of that later. The CoLeMinder system is proprietary. It's one of these dedicated companies producing one machine. The data goes up into Vena Water Quality Monitoring cloud servers in Europe, and then we draw that information into here. Another thing, two other areas that I talked about, you know, what are the other sources that we wanted? So in the proof of concept, I wanted the ability to input manual data collection. So whether this might be actually, you know, we will probably go out and occasionally grab a sample of water from the river itself, send it off to the lab for a test. We want to be able to add that data into it. Or maybe it's a farm management decision. Maybe it's where an irrigator is going, it may be where the travelling irrigator is turned on or not, or whether it's which paddocks the animals are in. So the ability to manually add your own data. And then also to think about what publicly available data is sitting out in the cloud that you can just scrape and add it into your information systems. So whether that's a regional councils have rain gauges and flow monitoring systems, and we have lots of weather data with rainfall and wind and solar radiation. So we just chose pulling rainfall data off the NIWA clouds as a proof for the proof of concept. In the middle, I've got the Neon system from there that does the data logging system and uploads the information to the internet. All of these require cellular coverage, and even on our farm at Invermay, the two sites that I just used as our test case eventually are 200 metres apart. One of them I could use with a small, had to put an aerial about yay long on top before I finally got coverage, even though there are towers sitting in Mosgiel. The other one's further up the hill, just slightly around the ridge, and ended up having to use a Yagi aerial, which kind of looked like a big TV aerial, pointed across at Mangatua's on the other side where there's a tower. So getting coverage in these areas is quite a challenge as well. The other thing that kind of threw me out a bit, the Trios sensors run with 12 to 24 volts, but we put really long cables on those so that we could move them around to different sites because the cables are dedicated and we didn't want to be cutting and changing and buying new cables every time we shifted sites that we're using them at. But with a 20 metre long cable, 12 volts won't work. So what we've got with the Neon system, and if you run, they will run continuously because they're just a light sensor, they will use more power than we can supply them with from a solar powered system because we want to be using in remote sites. So what the Neon system in the middle there is doing is actually turning on every 15 minutes, boosting the 12 volt power supply source to 24 volts, driving that information into the Trios sensors, running the wipers to clean the lenses, taking a reading and then shutting them down after 90 seconds, and then going back to sleep and repeating that cycle every 15 minutes because we can't keep the power supply up to them. And so most of the stuff on that data panel there is just getting the 24 volt power supply into these things. All sorts of challenges. One of the other interesting ones we've got is your timestamp. So the NIWA systems in New Zealand run on New Zealand standard time, and they don't shift for daylight saving because that just causes problems every time you're trying to align your data sets. Whereas if you're going to be a farmer manually entering information into your system, looking at your watch maybe when you're doing it, you're probably going to be New Zealand standard time. So every time we change the clocks, you're going to be wanting to be careful about how you align your data, because over summer your watch and the NIWA systems will be wrong. And then the CoLeMinder systems from Vienna Water Monitoring work in universal time coordinate, or for the older people in the audience, that's Greenwich Mean Time, and they can't change that at all. That's fixed into their systems. So when we start bringing all this data together, if we're going to try and interpret it, we've got to line it up so at least it's matching time-wise. So then this is just some mock-ups from here. I'm not running live on anything here, but this is just some initial mock-ups we've got of, you know, what we thought would be useful to have in a dashboard for somebody to go in and look at this data. So at a high level on the top right, we've got a whole lot of symbols of like swimming and fishing and drinking and habitat. And so maybe we could have those changing colours from green to red to orange, depending on what the levels were. So you could immediately sort of have an idea whether that was like. Across the top, we've got the individual measurements that we've got and the latest reading at which those timestamps would come. Actually, if we go to the next slide. You can see there's a timestamp. So whenever you go into the dashboard, it says this is the last data that I've pulled off the internet for you. And you can see that. Yeah, on the right we've got those symbols, on the left hopefully highlighting. Yep. You can then basically select which site you want to select, have a look at the data from, and then down the left there's a whole series of tick boxes, and then there's some default levels for the data range or time frame over which you might want to have a look at the information. That across the top is the most recent reading for all of those. The next point I've got there is integrated data. So basically in behind all of this is a massive database that's storing all that information. So it's all there, you can download it later on and do some information with it. And that for me is, you know, the potential as a science geek to do some future AI analysis. So the patterns that we may or may not see as a scientist that I'm trained to do, if we build up some really large data sets, then maybe the artificial intelligence might identify some patterns that we haven't, and particularly relationships between measures that we hadn't thought of. We then have a data dictionary, which we use for storing metadata. So one of the troubles is when you've got data that's coming into the cloud from different sources and then you're manipulating and moving it around, it's very easy to lose track of what it is. So your data dictionary is where we're containing all that information that says, this is the information, this is where it come from, this is the units it's in, so that you don't get, you know, some bit of data that might come in kilograms per hectare getting mixed up with something that comes in tons per hectare. It can make a big difference about how you use that data in the future. And then the last one we've got sitting across here is actually the monitoring system itself. So just like your car has a whole lot of flashing lights on the dashboard to tell you when things are wrong, when you've got remote equipment, a fair bit of the monitoring just goes into just telling you that the system's running okay. And this one here is just a little snapshot of the battery voltage of our solar panel systems before they shut down over COVID. So then this is where some of the data looks like, and this one here is just that tryptophan data because it's nice and scattered and shows us some of the challenges we've got. So what we've got, and here is a system. So actually if I start on the right and work back to the left, so that's the most recent reading with a level of 8.31 micrograms per litre, and it's related to swimming water quality, so that's why the swimming signal was there. Then you've got all the data which is highly scattered, and we've just got a fitted line through the middle that tells us sort of what the average is looking like, and you can see it's not really going up or down too much. And then on the left, I've just got a histogram there, which is a graph showing the distribution of all the concentrations that are in there. So what you can see when that level of 8.3, you can tell immediately that it's actually about in the middle of where the numbers have been coming out. So in terms of how you might start using that to interpret it, is useful. So then some of the challenges might be, how would you try and overlay the data? So we're looking at a system here of five layers worth of data. So we might have in the green dots might be the data that we're getting out of one of their sensors. The grey line going through there might be a moving average over several hours. There's blue vertical lines through there, which is related to rainfall. And so they are become darker when you've got more intense rain. So you're starting to see patterns of rainfall behind that. Across the middle there we've got paddocks A, B and C, which is basically saying which paddocks the cows have been moved to. And then the yellow dots on there might be some grab samples of the water quality that we've sensed. But already you can see, starting trying to integrate even five different data sources into one figure that you can start looking at gets really challenging, and that's where we need to start moving to working with end users and working with actual farmers to see what they do with that information. So this one here is just some snapshots or some screenshots from here. One of the other key challenges we've got is the data engineer who did all the work in the background that I can't do, streaming the data through the cloud and producing this, got it all working fine on a dashboard, but I couldn't see it on my computer. It had to run on her own computer. So then she went and worked with Microsoft Azure systems, so I could then log into it and see it from the cloud. And that worked really well, except we probably would have gone broke if we did that, because these things start generating a lot of data. and you need to then manage and manipulate that. And so she still hasn't quite finished a cheaper version of that because there's a data engineer, she keeps getting dragged off to help on other projects. But that's just some of the challenges that we're going to have to think of and deal with in this space. So in conclusion, there's still lots of challenges with getting this technology to work and work seamlessly. So with computers, we're all used to what we call plug and play. Nowadays, you buy a new mouse and you just plug it in and hey, presto, it works on here. This water quality sensing technology, I call it plug and pray, and you hope it's going to work from there. And with digital stuff, it's quite different. I started working in areas with analog systems with voltage outputs, and you could put a voltmeter on one piece of equipment and you could read what was coming out of it to see where the problem was in the data logging system. But with digital stuff, it either works or it doesn't, and you've got to think of other ways of fixing it. There's still a lot of work to do with dealing with variability and with time lags in the system before this information can become useful. And there's a lot of challenges with visualizing, you know, multiple data sources for multiple people to use as well. So you can imagine some squiggly lines and some big spikes on there. It might be useful for farmers to see, but not necessarily for public or people who don't know how to interpret the data, because they'll turn around and go, is that bad, or that number looks really high, that must be something terrible. So on some projects I work with my friends from the city, where they go, oh, are your farmers being bad yet? And it's like, well, actually, I don't know what good looks like, because I haven't had the data at this scale to know whether it's realistic or not. And so the next phase from here is to go on and look at co-developing this proof of concept into something that's useful with some farmers. And we're linking that up with virtual fencing technology as well, so we can look at using the two technologies in remote places to see if we can, you know, prove that the virtual fencing technology has an impact on the water quality, as well as proving the water quality stuff can detect changes. So, thank you.